Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is now 1:04 PM, Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. Here with us producing a quorum is everybody but Representative Fields. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Kieran, and our LIO moderator, Lydia. Folks, please silence their cell phones and set them up on a pad so we don't hear the vibration through the table. On today's agenda, it's the rescheduling of the Council of Alaska Producers and Alaska Mining Association presentation. With those two organizations, we have with us Karen Mathias with CAP and Deanta Crockett from Alaska Mining Association. Also here is Tech, being represented by Greta Shirk and Wayne Hall. I would like you folks to please put your name on the record and begin your presentation, and however you want to manage questions or comments, we can work through that as they come up. So,
thank you, Chair Patkatak and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Karen Mathias. I'm the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers, established in 1992. It's the statewide trade association for the large producing metal mines and several advanced projects.
Good afternoon, Chairman Patkatak, members of the committee. Greta Shirk, I am senior advisor for government and external affairs for Tech Alaska, the operator of Red Dog Mine, and I'm based in Kotzebue.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Wayne Hall. I'm the manager for community and public relations for Tech Alaska Red Dog Mine. I do work at the mine, but I live here in Juneau, so I've been a long time Alaskan.
And for the record, my name is Deanta Skabinski. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is the association that represents all aspects of the mining industry, from large-scale mines, our state's coal mine, family-owned plaster mines, and the vendor and contracting businesses that support our industry. And I'm going to kick us off today.
All right. Take it away, Ms. Spinski.
Karen is training me on the mouse here.
Representative Fields is here, 1:06 p.m.
Thank you. So what we plan to share with you today includes global factors, the existing and the predicted significant increase of demand for minerals worldwide. We'll talk about our reliance on foreign sources of these minerals and the policies that are needed to produce more of them here at home. Truly here at home, we'll talk about why Alaska is the place that we should focus to produce the minerals we need. And we'll end by spotlighting the benefits of mining for Alaska and Alaskans throughout our state. So you've likely heard it said that minerals underpin everything we do, from the airbags in our cars, from medical devices, from the fact that we could walk into this room and turn on the light. Our way of life as we know it is impossible without mining and without minerals. Our dependency on all of these conveniences requires their steady production worldwide. But in terms of obtaining those minerals we need, we've really only just begun. The pursuit of renewable technologies that we'll talk more about today and energy storage has sent and will continue to send worldwide demand of minerals surging. The production of these minerals has got to surge as well. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency, and other entities have studied the global energy goals and are projecting a massive increase in mineral needs moving forward. For instance, the IEA found that the typical electric car requires 6 times the components from a conventional vehicle, and an onshore wind plant requires 9 times the minerals than a similar-sized gas-fired power plant. The energy sector's overall needs could increase as much as 6 times by 2040, and we'd like to be a part of that. So please note that even though more minerals are required to pursue new technologies, the World Bank has shown that the overall carbon footprint from the mineral extraction all the way to the end use will be far less than current technologies that we use today. So when we look at the growing demand for minerals, we have to think about where we're going to get them. And let's first address recycling. Recycling is something that we should continue to pursue, and we should invest in technology to improve the efficacy of recycling as part of our mineral strategy. But it's still not going to be enough. Another projection from the World Bank is that even if we double the recycling rates for base metals like copper and aluminum, it's still not going to get us there. In fact, the IEA report that I mentioned identified 6 important pillars of a broad approach to mineral security, of which recycling was only one. They emphasize a priority on ensuring adequate investment in diversified sources of new supply, including strong signals from policymakers to create conditions conducive to investment, such as reinforcing national geological surveys, streamlining permitting procedures to shorten lead times, providing financing support to de-risk projects, and raising public awareness of the contributions that such projects play to the transformation of the energy sector. They also promote technology innovation, examining the resilience of the supply chain, rewarding operations with high environmental excellence as operations that set good examples, and fostering a dialogue between producers and consumers to understand where minerals come from. So to summarize, kind of an all-of-the-above approach is really the only way to meet our needs. And we haven't quite achieved a strategy on how to get there. In this report, the IEA executive director sums this up quite nicely in his quote, where he says, "Today, the data shows a looming mismatch between the world's strength and climate ambitions and the availability of critical minerals that are essential to realizing those ambitions. The challenges are not insurmountable, but governments must give clear signals about how they plan to turn their climate pledges into action. By acting now and acting together, they can significantly reduce the risks of price volatility and supply disruptions." So we can reflect that Alaska as a state, we meet all of these pillars for an approach to mineral security. But in particular, the first and the last points, this is what Alaska is about. We are a new source of minerals, and we do it right here in Alaska. This is an area where we really shine. Left. Thank you. So knowing that we have to increase mining to meet our needs, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, where do we want this mining to take place, and where do you want mining to occur? So certainly over the last month, we've watched political instability unfold in our world. The increasing global insecurity and the disruption to our supply chains is really echoing across the country. It's a conversation a lot of us are having across the globe. And we've seen how weak the global supply chain really is. And it's given us pause that domestically sourcing what we need not only makes our nation stronger, but it helps us help those that are more vulnerable. And if there's one thing we can all agree on, and this is not a partisan issue, is the security of our nation and helping those that are vulnerable. But the minerals that we need are currently being mined in unfriendly countries with the ability to hold our economy hostage. 90% of our rare earth needs are coming from China, and the majority of the world's cobalt is being produced in the Congo, where children are employed in very poor conditions. So we have to ask ourselves, where do we want mining to happen? Do we want it in the Congo, or do we want it in places like Alaska with strong safety and environmental laws? Senator Murkowski really said it best when she talked about our reliance on foreign adversaries for critical mineral needs. We are vulnerable in this sense because of our dependence, and it does disadvantage us. And if we want to change that here, we have to improve our federal permitting system. Our nation's laws are among the strongest and the most stringent in the world, but recent changes in their implementation has resulted in a negative impact on their investment and with no added benefit to the environment or safety. So the bullets that are on this slide summarize the fundamental policies needed to grow mining in the United States. These are the building blocks of what it takes to get more mineral investment in our country. It's unfortunate that I have to tell you in the last year we've taken major steps backwards. While our current federal administration touts the desire to achieve the climate goals I discussed a moment ago, and it acknowledges more mining has to take place, and in some cases has gone as far as to say that that mining should take place domestically, it really hasn't acted accordingly. So the bullets on this slide summarize things like we need access to mineral deposits, and particularly in Alaska, most of our mineral potential is remote. And with the patchwork of land ownership we have, exploring a mineral deposit on federal lands has gotten more challenging. And even looking at a deposit on state or privately owned land, in most cases, you'll probably have to cross federal lands and access those federal lands. And instead of multiple use management and ensuring access to those lands, the Biden administration has instigated significant changes to land management that has inhibited that access. We've also seen a cancellation of recent improvements to our nation's permitting process, the National Environmental Policy Act. NEPA was created alongside our nation's environmental laws, and over time, the process has really swelled, and it has resulted in documents that are thousands of pages, have limitless topic areas outside of the scope of the project proposal, and they can take years to compile, and it's become difficult for agencies and project proponents to manage, and it has become incredibly difficult for the public to engage in that process. Recent attempts made the process as thorough, but more efficiently managed. But those changes have been rolled back, and the previous collaboration that took place between the miscellaneous regulatory agencies has been rolled back as well. So if we want to look at how mining in America can be improved, I will ask you to consider announcements that took place over the last month that affected Alaska. So on February 22nd, the White House introduced its next steps to a critical minerals strategy titled Securing a Made in America Supply Chain for Critical Minerals. It emphasized the importance of critical minerals produced domestically, but buried in the announcement were directives to the Department of Interior to begin reform two mining laws, in a fashion that will continue to erode investment. That same day, the same Department of Interior announced that it had asked a federal court to remand the final permit for the Ambler Road and to reopen the environmental analysis, alleging deficiencies in that process. So this was a process that spanned three federal administrations. It had dozens of public meetings throughout Alaska, and in particularly along the proposed road corridor, and had multiple opportunities for public comment. So this is obviously a decision we're disappointed with. So I know this slide has a lot of information, but it paints a picture of the magnitude of the challenges we have with the federal administration. And I know we're providing this update to a committee of the state legislature, but we wanted to highlight how much federal policy drives so much of what we do. And I'll end and turn it over to Karen and by highlighting that our industry really believes in engaging with the public early and often. It brings significant benefit to everyone. And often I'm approached by companies that are just getting into Alaska and they're asking, you know, how can we be successful as we look toward investing in this particular project? And Karen and I always encourage them to talk to the community residents at the very beginning. It's imperative that we work with the local residents and the general public, and we hear their priorities and concerns. And we don't just talk to them, we listen, and ultimately we see a better project proposal because of that engagement. And it's something we really believe in, and you're going to hear more about that later in terms of a clear partnership between company and community at Red Dog. So with that, thank you, and I'll pass it back to Karen.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Council of Alaska Producers. So Deantha covered the soaring demand for minerals to build the technologies that we need for lower emissions and a low-carbon future. And we know that increasing domestic production is good for our nation's economy and security. So let's make sure that Alaska gets its fair share of that investment so we can be part of both the national solution and at the same time help grow Alaska's economy. What are Alaska's advantages? We have a great story to tell. I'll start with the mineral potential in the state, and then I'll cover the strict environmental regulations. Alaska's mines demonstrate every day by operating to the highest environmental and safety standards that mining can and is being done right in Alaska. When it comes to mineral potential, the Fraser Institute annual global survey of mining companies consistently rates Alaska in the top five jurisdictions for its pure mineral potential. So we went to DGGS at the Department of Natural Resources, that's the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and asked them for a map that shows that potential, the resources, the mineral resources in Alaska. And it's actually a tough request because there's so much that it's hard to put on one map. They actually have a number of maps. So we picked the one that we thought would give a good example of the minerals that we're particularly interested in. And it's a very, very busy map, but that is a good thing. It would be even busier if it actually showed all the mineral occurrences. But this actually starts with the circles, which are the prospects. And prospects are places where a geologist has found an occurrence, and the company is interested in doing some soil sampling, some mapping, maybe some remote sensing to determine what might be there in the hope of a discovery. Because discovery then leads to drilling to see if there's real potential. The diamonds on this map are those exploration projects. Alaska has at least 44 active projects that range all the way from early stage exploration to advanced development. And then finally, if you can see it amongst all of those symbols on the map, there are six stars which represent the six large operating mines. They're pretty hard to see, but we do have an upcoming slide with a clearer picture of the mines and some of the advanced projects. But when you look at this map, it begs the question, if Alaska has so many projects and prospects, why so few mines? Deposits need to be of sufficient quantity and quality to be economically feasible given the high costs of access and energy compared to other places. Alaska has its challenges, our remote locations, our lack of infrastructure, the expensive energy that drives up the costs of developing mines. And right now, like every other industry, we're also dealing with labor shortages and supply chain delays. And as Deantha mentioned, there's the unpredictability in federal permitting, which also sends a negative message to investors and companies. Even in the best of circumstances, it's still a long process to bring a mine into production. This graphic was actually created a couple of years ago, and in a perfect world, the feasibility and permitting periods that are shown here are accurate, but recently they've been taking even longer. Fortunately, miners are tenacious, and momentum is building. As global demand for minerals increases, commodity prices should stay robust, and projects are moving forward. We believe that we are truly on the cusp of realizing our potential in Alaska. Meanwhile, our large mines have been in production for many years and they're still going strong. They continually do more exploration and they're permitting expansions so that they can continue to operate in years ahead. So let's look a little closer at mining in our state. We all know that oil contributes more than any other industry to state revenue, but we're really proud of the contribution mining makes, and it could be even more if we brought even one new mine into operation. What this map really demonstrates, though, is the regional impact of mining. The red stars show our large mines. They operate 24/7 year-round, and together they had 3,000 employees and on-site contractors in 2020. So going from north to south, they are the Red Dog Mine, which is the world's largest zinc concentrate producer. It's an open pit mine on Nana land, and you'll hear more about it from Greta and Wayne. Fort Knox is Alaska's largest producing gold mine. It's located just outside Fairbanks, so their employees are able to live in the Fairbanks North Star borough and commute to work. Pogo is an underground gold mine near Delta Junction. Pogo built and maintains a 50-mile road to access the mine from the road system. Usabelli Coal Mine, immediately adjacent to Denali National Park, has been in operation since 1943, and the mine has been family-owned since that time. In southeast Alaska, we have two large underground mines, the Kensington Gold Mine and Greens Creek, which is the top silver producer in the United States. These two mines are the largest private sector employers and the largest property taxpayers in the city and borough of Juneau. Workers at both these mines commute to work by boat. We also have two projects in the permitting process, which are depicted by the blue triangles, and that's Donlin in western Alaska and Pebble in southwest. This mine also highlights our current advanced exploration projects with green circles, which are from north to south, the Upper Kobuk, which is the Ambler Mining District in northwest Alaska, the Graphite Creek project near Nome, Livengood near Fairbanks, Mancho and Tetlin, Palmer near Haines, and Niblack on Prince of Wales Island. Keep in mind there are dozens more projects and deposits, some of which you may have heard of, like Dawson, a small underground gold mine, and Bokan Mountain, a rare earth project, both on Prince of Wales Island. But finally, our favorite part of this map are the yellow circles, which represent the more than 90 Alaska communities where mining industry employees live. And as you can see, they're pretty fairly distributed throughout the state. And I'm going to hand it back to Deantha to talk about placer mines.
Thank you. For the record, Deantha Skubinski, Alaska Miners Association. And here I'd like to have a look at what we commonly refer to as our seventh large mine, and this is collectively the approximately 170 placer mining operations across the state. Placer mining is a small-scale mining method where gold is recovered from dirt using water and gravity, very small in scale. If I were to take you to one of these mines, or if Senator Bishop took you to his, you'd probably think I took you to like a neighborhood construction project, yellow iron moving dirt around. It wouldn't wildly jump out at you that you're actually at a mine until you got in and looked at the recovery. They're generally very small in footprint. They have an average of 4 employees. Some are a little bit larger and some are only one that does everything. Many are family owned and they all operate seasonally when the ground isn't frozen. So now that we've discussed mineral uses and the mining that takes place in Alaska, we'd like to cover the environmental regime that Alaska's miners work within. We maintain that Alaska's mining operations and the agencies that regulate them they account for what makes a world-class regulatory system. Our mines are permitted for the protection of all aspects of the environment, so air, land, water, fish, human health, and wildlife. We strive to reduce our emissions as well as our energy and water consumption by continuously seeking efficiencies and improvements in all aspects of the operation. And there's strict regulatory oversight throughout the mine life, from the first foot on the ground, and it doesn't end when the mine closes. There's extensive planning beforehand for the mine closure and continued oversight of the mine post-closure for reclamation to restore the site. And there's tailored financial assurance, meaning that if for some reason the state has to step in and perform that reclamation, the money is there to cover the cost. So here's an overview of what it takes to permit a mine. This is a slide supplied by the Department of Natural Resources, and it's very wordy, but what's here is important. It shows that the planning and the environmental study and review and testing and approval process to permit a large mine in Alaska takes many years from start to finish, with dozens of local and state and federal government agencies involved in that process. The permits listed up here on this slide are what is typical for a mine on state or privately owned land, still with a very large amount of federal authorizations. A mine that is being proposed on federally owned land brings many additional permits, such as those that would be under the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service regulations. All permits contain multiple stipulations in addition to compliance with statutes and regulations. And what I mean when I say this is that agencies can and they often do prescribe additional practices to be performed by the mine that are outside of or in addition to the governing laws. So the main point of this slide is to show that there is no one yes decision to approve a mine in Alaska. There's no rubber stamp process that has guaranteed approval. Every mine is different, and it requires a tailor-made plan for environmental mitigation. And that plan is very often discussed and altered at length back and forth between the project proponent and the regulatory agencies before it is allowed to advance to a stage forward. Again, a PowerPoint slide with a lot going on. This is also supplied by DNR. And this drills down into the state of Alaska's specific environmental management and provides an overview of how many agencies and departments are involved in evaluating mining proposals and what their monitoring roles are throughout that process. So in addition to the no automatic approval that I discussed a moment ago, it's equally important to understand that continuously throughout this process, there are multiple opportunities for public participation. Here you can see that there are 13 permits where public notice is required and an additional 4 where the public notice is done by the state as a courtesy. So this process is transparent, and it's really designed to ensure the public has a voice in the mining activity that takes place in our state.
For the record, Karen Mathias. So Diantha covered the rigorous permitting, and I want to look at the strict oversight during the operational life of the mine. Alaska has one of the best water quality monitoring systems in the world with respect to mines. It has 3 distinct parts. First, we do water quality monitoring, which is fairly standard globally, although our system may be more comprehensive than many. But in Alaska, we take a further step, which is less common in other jurisdictions, and we do biomonitoring. So our Department of Fish and Game oversees monitoring of the algae, the benthic environment, and fish, including minerals uptake, habitat, and population. And the third part is that Alaska is one of the few, perhaps the only jurisdiction that requires periodic third-party monitoring of not only the company's compliance, but also third-party monitoring of the state agency that oversees the company's reports and results. I don't know of any other place that does all 3 of these and in this depth, and that's something we can all be proud of. The strict regulatory oversight before and during operations continues all the way through reclamation and closure. The requirements for reclamation and closure are not well understood, so I want to make a few key points. First, a mine's plan for reclamation and closure must be approved by the Commissioner of Natural Resources before operations are allowed to begin. This is mandated by law. Second, in addition to approving the reclamation plan, mines must also provide financial assurance at the outset. This is not a fund for the company's use to do their reclamation work. These funds are guaranteed to the state, so if for some reason the company is unable to perform the reclamation, the state can step in and they don't have to use state money to do so. Third, it does not matter where the company is headquartered or who owns the land. every company that mines in Alaska must comply with these financial assurance requirements. They apply to all companies operating or mining in Alaska. And finally, the amount required isn't just set at the outset and then forgotten. Financial insurance guarantees are reviewed every 5 years or earlier if there's a significant change. Before I go to the next slide, I just want to draw your attention to the two photos here. They were taken 6 months apart. It's an impressive change to see in just 6 months, but it's just the start of a multi-year process.
Ms. Mathias, before we move on, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Mathias, back on the slide, two back where it's the permit graphic that you said was provided by DNR, and one of the categories.
Next one.
Right. Courtesy public notice. So I'm curious whether that's from DNR or from the mine. And then I've got a couple other questions, depending on who gives that notice.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, Deantha Skabinski, Alaska Miners Association. This is a slide supplied to us by DNR, and this is where they state that is their role, that they do courtesy public notice of those permits. They aren't required to do so, but they do.
So follow up. So for example, reclamation and closure plans, DNR gives a courtesy notice to the public when that plan is filed or when reclamation is being executed.
Yeah, Wayne, for the record, Wayne Hall. So for reclamation and closure plan approvals, there is a public review process that DNR goes through is required. As far as the other part of your question around actually conducting reclamation, there's not necessarily a public process for that where they notify it. But I don't know of any mine that doesn't engage heavily with all the communities and around reclamation. For example, we have concurrent reclamation, which means it's going on at the same time that we're mining. So you just don't do it all at the end. And you know, our relationship with our communities are very important. So I can only speak to what we do. We tend to let not only when the agencies issue the public notice, we in turn let the communities know because we're not always certain that they're paying attention to the different ways, you know, newspapers, websites, et cetera. So we always make a point to reach out to them to make sure that they're aware that those permits are pending.
One more
follow-up.
So I'm just trying to fathom it because you had to put in the reclamation plan before you started operations. But, you know, best case scenario, you're not doing that reclamation for 20 years or 30 years. So is the notice to the public that's a courtesy notice, it's executed when you're beginning that reclamation plan 20 years down the road or when the plan was approved 20 years earlier?
For the record, Wayne Hall. I've never heard the term courtesy. I see it's on their form here. Every reclamation and closure plan approval that goes or that's proposed, that goes out to the public, it's renewed every 5 years. So every time that goes out, DNR notifies the public that the plan is up for review on its five-year cycle, allows opportunities to provide comment on how, you know, for consideration on how the plan or the permit may need to be modified. And in that five-year renewal, it will include the updates that the mine does from year to year because that's part of the renewal process is how much has been reclaimed, where are you at now, what is the financial assurance requirements? Because that's a big part of any reclamation and closure plan process is how much financial assurance is now required for the size of the operation and the amount of disturbed lands versus reclaimed lands. So it's a iterative process that happens every 5 years.
Thank you.
I think we could pick up where we left off, unless you have anything to add to that, Ms. Mathias.
For the record, Karen Mathias, just to point out, and I can do so with my slide, is that for many, if not most of the companies, its reclamation doesn't start 20 years later. There is ongoing reclamation, and this is actually a really good example of that. So I'll speak to Yusbeli. The other thing is that I think we're always very cautious about speaking to the exact mechanisms that DNR uses. It's really better that the agency speak for itself. So we can talk to them about providing follow-up to you about that, the precise mechanisms for their courtesy public notice.
I've been engaging with DNR over mental health trust lands notification, and that was the first place I encountered courtesy notifications, is a term they use. So seeing it in your permitting process is what drew my attention, because basically mental health trust lands have no required notifications. It's all courtesy notifications. And so to see it here, just like, it's not unique to them, but that's the only place that I'd encountered it before the slide.
Right, and I think to that point, as far as community input and all of that, I'm actually excited to pivot over to Tech's presentation, because I know that they've done a lot as far as community input. And I've experienced it from the oil and gas side, and it's curious to me to see how that is from the mining side. And as far as I know, it's good, if not better. Before we move on, Representative Gillum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The previous slide, this is just for my own knowledge, I guess. That picture in January looks to me like someplace in Arizona, not Alaska in January. So I'm just curious.
There's no snow that winter.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a wintertime picture. How is that?
Kronk didn't catch many wolves. He said there was no snow that winter. So.
Yeah, wind blew it away.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Council of Alaska Producers, Representative Gillum through the chair. We'll let Isabelle provide that information to you. Those are the dates that we were given. The point of that slide is to really show the contouring work that was done, and then the revegetation, of course. But we'll double check those dates with you.
Okay, I appreciate it. Like I said, that was just kind of from my own information, and I understand how the reclamation stuff works, but just didn't look right to me. Thanks.
That's how good they are with snow management. Representative Rauscher.
I just wanted to comment that I've had no snow on the ground in my yard in February, and all I've had is grass exposed. It was about 8 years ago, but I've seen that before, so.
Thank you, Representative. Please continue, Ms. Mathias.
For the record, Karen Mathias, thank you. So as I mentioned, reclamation is a multi-year process. And we'll look a little bit more at Isabelle. The lush spruce forest in this photo is on land that was mined. Alaska's coal mining laws require a three-phase bonding process. Phase one is the backfilling and regrading, and this can occur within the first year of mining. But phase two, the planting of native vegetation and establishing drainages, can often take several years. Phase three requires the successful completion of the first two phases, plus a minimum of 10 years after completing phase two, and 2 years of vegetation studies to validate that there's sufficient vegetative cover and diversity. When beginning to mine coal in the Poker Flats area near Denali National Park almost 40 years ago, Isabelle Coal Mine committed to restoring the land and posted a bond backing the promise. This was before reclamation was required. They did it because it was the right thing to do. And in September 2021, the Department of Natural Resources declared that Isabelle had achieved that top phase three status. And as you can see, we can and do develop our land to produce resources to meet the state's energy and economic needs, and then restore the land to provide healthy habitat for people and wildlife. I have a second example. This is True North, which was operated by Kinross. And honestly, I can't say it better than Commissioner Feige. She said the developers leased state land, produced a valuable commodity to serve global markets, employed Alaskans, and paid state taxes and royalties. When they were done, they remediated the effects of their work and returned the land to the state for its next use. The system works. So I mentioned Commissioner Feige mentioned, you know, some of the benefits from a mining operation, creating jobs, paying the state and local taxes that help fund public services. But there's so much more that can make a difference in a community, whether it's vocational training and scholarships, supporting Alaska businesses by purchasing goods and services locally, training, support for Alaska nonprofits, or promoting a safety culture and teaching skills that get passed on at home and in our communities. So rather than try to give too brief an overview of the ways that the mines and projects collaborate with all the different communities around the state, we decided to go deeper with one example. And we asked Greta Shirk and Wayne Hall from Tech Alaska to share what community partnerships look like at Red Dog.
Thank you, Karen. For the record, Greta Shirk with Tech Alaska. I'm going to go over a few slides here, and I'll circle back to community engagement when the time is right. But this,
For the record, what was your Inupiaq name again?
Inurak. Upanga Inurak.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Alakrak. So this slide here is another form of a benefit tree that Tech and Nana put together a few years back. And you see here, I won't get into too much detail. We could always cover that later or following the committee hearing today. But one of the most important points I want to point out in here is the local control branch there. And many of you may know. Let me back up a little bit. So Red Dog is located in the Northwest Arctic Borough. It is operated by Tech, and the land is owned by Nana Regional Corporation. And Red Dog has been in operation since 1989, so a little over 30 years. And in advance of development at Red Dog, the region came together, my home region. I grew up there in Kayana on the Kobuk River. And as mentioned earlier, currently live in Kotzebue, but in advance of the development of Red Dog, the region came together and made a decision to form the Northwest Arctic Borough. And that is really what drives the local control, some of the other benefits that I want to just point out in here is the Nana royalty, which I'll get to in the next slide, and the royalty payments made to Nana, as well as 7i payments made to other Alaska regional corporations around Alaska Native corporations, I'm sorry. So some of the broad benefits of development you see here, since mining began, and this is through fiscal year 2021, proceeds paid to Nana, $2.65 billion, and $1.6 of that has been paid to other Alaska Native corporations through the 7i provision in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. For the state, $1.4 billion has been paid to state to ADA through 2021, and that is for use of the DeLong Mountain Transportation System, which is the road, the haul road that connects the mine to the port site. It's a 52-mile road that connects the mine site to the port where our product is exported during shipping season. $308 million has been paid to the Northwest Arctic Borough in a payment in lieu of taxes since mining began in 1989. And $207 million has been spent on goods and services in Alaska through 2021. And then you'll see the final number there, approximately $80 million in wages paid since 2021. As I mentioned earlier, Tech pays a payment in lieu of taxes to the Northwest Arctic Borough. The most recent numbers are listed here. $20 to $26 million in PILT is paid annually. The PILT makes up about 85 to 90% of the borough's revenue. Under the most recent agreement between Tech and the Northwest Arctic Borough, a new carve out, a separate fund from the PILT was formed, and that's called the Village Improvement Fund. And this fund we pay anywhere from $4 to $8 million annually. The average in recent years, the average since it's began has been the ceiling of $8 million. And this fund is administered by a commission, and the commission is made up of residents of the 11 communities of the borough. Each of the 11 communities selects its commissioner, and they decide, they receive and evaluate and analyze the many, many applications that they receive from our villages in the region. And then they prioritize those and decide on how this money will be allocated. And then eventually the assembly provides final approval for the use of these funds.
Ms. Shirk, before we move on, Representative Hanna had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Shirk, my question is about the payments to ADA for the road. My recollection was that at some point the road was to be paid off, or is it an ongoing annual expense? I thought the ADA loan when it was made was 25-year lifespan, and that, you know, it would then just be the operational maintenance of tech or the operator of the mine. Am I incorrect?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I'm going to turn that over to Wayne to answer that. I'm not sure I understood the – there's a couple questions within that, but go ahead.
Yeah, for the record, Wayne Hall. The way the ADA agreement and that number that was shown, that also includes Alaska mining license tax and corporate taxes as well. But with ADA, you're right, it was a 25 or 30-year financing, if you will. The road and the facilities are a state asset. And in, I think it was 96, we looked at expanding the capacity of the mine, and through that also needed to expand the capacity of the port. So there was an expansion. So there was another round of financing, if you will. So, the way that, it's paid back, it's basically like a toll agreement. So for every ton of concentrate that's shipped through the facility, which includes the road as well, there's a toll that Tech pays to the state for the use of that facility.
Just one follow-up. And so that is anticipated to continue for the life of the mine. It's not that you would get out from under the toll and...
That would be my expectation, yeah. It's a, you know, if somebody else owns the asset, and they want, there's some kind of agreement. But that would probably come after the point when it's been paid in full. And I imagine it'd be some kind of negotiation process. But again, that's... lack of knowledge on my part, but that's how I would assume it would probably happen.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the presenters before we move on? Seeing none, Ms. Shirk.
Thank you. Greta Shirk, for the record. I wanted just to point out a few of the projects that have been funded by the Village Improvement Fund. These are just a handful of 61 projects that have been funded to the communities around the North West Arctic Borough since the inception of the Village Improvement Fund in 2016. I won't go into detail again. You have copies of this presentation. And Mr. Chairman, I'm gonna go off script for a little bit because I feel like when I talk, oh, there's my niece. Actually, I see her here. It makes me feel
technically
a little,
still on script.
Yeah. So I feel like I can't talk fully about the benefits of the development of Red Dog without first looking back on what the region looked like, my home region looked like before Red Dog was developed. And I was just a little kid back then. Like I said, we began operating in 1989, and my dad was a truck driver and an operator, and he helped build the road that connects the mine to the port. But I was on a plane the other day from Anchorage to Kotzebue. I've been traveling a lot. I came back down afterwards, and I sat next to a revered elder from the region. And we got to talking, and I said, I let him know I was coming down here to chat with you all this week. And I said, hey, would you mind tell me what the region was like before Red Dog? And he paused, and he thought about it, and he said there were no jobs. There was a lot of hunting and trapping and a lot of subsistence hunting, of course. And while, you know, Mr. Chairman, we both enjoy that kind of livelihood, that it also requires cash to carry out and practice those practices that we've hunting and fishing that we've practiced for thousands of years. And he talked about the need to have to, back then they were having to, if they were lucky, they were able to get jobs up on the North Slope during the oil, beginning of the oil boom up there. He said, there were times when the occasional construction project would come to town. And, other than that, there was just, you know, there was really no economy, regional economy until Red Dog developed, came along. And during our conversation, I had to pause and thank him and remember some of the our late leaders like Robert Newland, who was the chairman of the board of NANA when they began considering whether they would move forward with the development of the mine. And I wanted to circle back to the question about community engagement. And before that was ever required by any agency or any government agency, NANA at the time took a decade back in the 70s and into the 80s, the leaders of NANA back then, to go around to the communities. And they spent a whole decade consulting with the residents of the 11 communities within the region before they ever made the decision to move forward to develop Red Dog. So I just wanted to spend a little time on that. I thanked him and I remember the leaders because my family and I have been beneficiaries of the development of Red Dog. Many of my friends and neighbors and people who live within the region, and I think of the opportunities that it's brought people who have lived in the region. It has given them the opportunity to of choice. Sometimes they choose to relocate to the Mat-Su Valley or to Anchorage or beyond other parts of Alaska. But it's also given people the opportunity to move back home. I know a couple of families and friends in Noatak who used to live in the Mat-Su Valley, and through their jobs and the living that they made at Red Dog, they were able to construct homes and relocate to their home in Noatak. So, like I said, just wanted to go off script a bit and talk about that. But back to the presentation, some of the most recent numbers, we always refer to the agreement between Teck and NANA as the 1982 agreement. It was negotiated between then Cominco, which was later, was merged with Teck and is now Teck Alaska. In that agreement, there is a hiring preference for NANA shareholders. NANA now has over 14,500 shareholders growing every day. And some recent shareholder hire numbers there on the screen. 527 regular employees, 56% are NANA shareholders, 57, and then 96.7% of our seasonal and temporary hires are NANA shareholders. And these are just Teck Alaska numbers. They don't include our Tier 1 contractors who include many of NANA's subsidiaries.
And, you know, on that page, something that I always keep track of back home when we talk about our oil and gas property tax being 98% of the borough budget, I think you said 94-95% of the Northwest Arctic borough budget is derived from the PILT and Teck. When you talk about the direct impact on employment, Teck W-2 employees, and you talk about your Tier 1 contractors, you also need to take into consideration, I do, all the borough jobs that are derived from the property tax that is able to be levied. And that's something to keep in mind when we look at opportunities in the different areas of rural Alaska that has that circulation of the dollar within the local economy. So thank you for this slide. It's
we need to know which one's your niece.
Oh, yeah.
Mid right on the bottom.
Representative Hannon through the chair. She's the second photo from the bottom to the right, and she's the one third.
With the hard hat or without the?
No, without the hard hat.
Okay.
Yep. She grew up there in the Mat-Su Valley with my sister, who's her mother, and she now lives in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Oh wow.
Another example of a Red Dog employee.
Yeah. And I was going to say, everybody's got their Costco cousin in the village. You got your cousin that's in Anchorage or Wasilla that's like your call for your once a month Costco shipment.
That's right. That's right.
Representative Gillum.
Thank you, to the chair. I'm just curious. You said you had 14,000 NANA shareholders, correct? you've got 527 regular employees. I'm just curious why half of them, or almost half, are not shareholders. Seems like you should be able to find another 200 out of that 14,000. And then 73% of your employees are Alaska residents. So to me, that's 27% that are not Alaska residents. I'm just kind of curious why you can't have more.
Sure. Representative Gillum, through the chair. The over 14,000 shareholders of NANA include minors. So my 2.5-year-old son, for example, and my 15-year-old son, they are also shareholders in NANA. So many of them are children. NANA made the decision decades ago to allow enrollment of what?
Afterborn.
What many Alaska Native corporations refer to afterborns, and afterborns are those who were born after the passage of ANCSA. And we'll get around to the next question in the next slide, and we want to talk about our trades and our apprenticeship programs. And I think, Wayne, I'm going to turn this over to you to provide some detail on these programs.
Mr. Hall, before we do that, were there any other questions on the previous slide from members? Seeing none.
For the record, Wayne Hall, Representative Gillum. To your question, a couple things. So there's 14,000 NANA shareholders. About 7,500 live in the region. So the other half live outside our lower 48, et cetera. And what we've had somewhere around 2,500 shareholders employed through Red Dog at one time or another in their career or worked there and then retired. The biggest challenges that we have on filling those, the non-shareholder roles, it's really in the professional fields. And often when you get young people that also go to, say, trade schools or post-secondary, now they're a wanted commodity, right? Now we're competing with everybody, including the oil industry, which is quite hard to do with the wages they pay. And also, Red Dog isn't necessarily the place where everybody wants to work. I had an individual that worked for me, got his environmental degree, worked for a couple of years, decided, you know, it just wasn't for me, and now he works for ASRC, which is great. You know, that's what you want to see. So we really struggle trying to get those very experienced technical positions filled. You know, the mining engineers, general managers typically have to have experience from a lot of different areas. So we're always striving to get better and better, and are working with our partner on how to do that. Greta will talk about one of the programs that we're doing. And I think the trades is the other area where we've got a real opportunity to, because I know there's a lot of people that are getting ready to retire, but those are probably the primary reasons.
Okay. Yep, back home we'd call that the war on talent.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Again, for the record, Wayne Hall. So this is a program that we're very proud of. It's as part of the agreement, there is what's called an employment and training committee between NANA and TEC, and they meet on a regular basis. And one of the things early on that they established was an in-house apprenticeship program, and it's really designed around those trades that you see to bring young people in that are excited about learning a new skill, getting them the tools they need and the support they need to get them to become journeymen. And this program is only for shareholders. They're the only ones that can qualify for it. You can see there right now approximately 25% of our trades are in the apprenticeship program, so pretty high percentage. And it's been quite successful. And one thing that we're real proud of there is the last one, which is the mill operator apprenticeship program. Representative Fields and I were talking today about a gentleman that was real instrumental in working together on developing this program, and it was the first one in the United States, and it commenced, as you see there, in 2016. So it's not without its challenges, like any program, but I think this is a model that's worked really well for us.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. First, I wanted to apologize. I have to leave early and go present a bill in a Senate committee. But I wanted to note Ted Zagarlik, the individual Mr. Hall is referring to, not only set up this first-in-the-nation, world-class program, but for the 3.5 years I worked at the Department of Labor, he would come into town every year for a statewide apprenticeship roundtable. And actually, the example he laid out inspired other employers throughout the state, including the Primary Care Association, to start statewide apprenticeship programs. So it served as a model far beyond the mining industry, and I just wanted to recognize that and thank him because his influence extends across the state. And sorry, I have to leave early.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, please proceed.
This is just thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Fields had to step out, but I wanted just to respond to his comment. And Ted Zagarlik was a longtime employee of Red Dog and retired a few years ago, but we miss him. And Wayne and I both noticed there on the wall the print of Red Dog, and I'm now wondering if that was something that maybe Ted facilitated to get down here during his tenure, his many decades of his time at Red Dog. But back to the slide. This was just an example of some Alaska-built infrastructure that we wanted to show. We recently added onto our accommodations complex there at Red Dog, and these accommodations modules were built at a facility in Big Lake, owned by NANA Construction, a subsidiary of NANA Regional Corporation. And then the one on the right, you see the powerhouse module that was shipped to our port site and then hauled up the 52-mile road that I mentioned earlier. That one was built in Anchorage. And then here is this is a picture of the port site. Like I mentioned earlier, is part of the DeLong Mountain Transportation road and port facilities. And then an example of the newish school in my hometown of Kiana. The formation of the borough has allowed it to use bonding for the construction of new schools in our communities. And this was a renovation and addition that was completed in, I believe, 2003. And that wraps up our formal presentation, and happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mrs. Shirk. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And if you'll indulge me, this question has nothing to do with your presentation. I happen to both Kensington and Greens Creek are in my district, and they were able to stay open and operational with their underground mines throughout COVID. And I have asked both of them to make sure I understood that their COVID policies that allowed them to stay open and what their current COVID mitigation plans included. And I, just so you don't feel blindsided, both of them have communicated strongly that they want control over their own COVID mitigation plans. They instituted significant quarantine periods. Mm-hmm. And for all new hires, they do require vaccines. They have, in one case, over 90% current employees have chosen to be vaccinated. The other one was 93. Mm-hmm. And they're not terminating anyone, but they are requiring any new hires to comply with that so that in the underground working conditions, their employees can stay safe and they can stay in control of a mitigation plan as private operators. And I, you know, so I'm curious to know what Tux has been and how surviving and keeping operational through the COVID period has been and what it has instituted for plans going forward.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Hannon. Through the chair, thank you for the question. I have a long answer. We have a lot of COVID mitigation policies and procedures that we've put into place. And at the onset of the pandemic in March of 2020, when we learned of the first case hitting Alaska, Tech and NANA came together immediately to begin
reviewing the situation, and we worked with our communities, consulted with our communities, worked very closely with NANA on what we might do, because given the small percent or the percentage of employees we have who live out of state and in Anchorage and elsewhere, it was our priority to protect the communities, the villages in the Northwest Arctic Borough and the NANA region. So at that time, a decision was made, and it was a really difficult decision to discontinue weekly flights from Red Dog into the villages. So our employees who live in those communities were required to go to, rather than working a 2 week on, 2 week off shift, they took on a 6 week shift with 2 weeks off. And during those 2 weeks off, they were required to quarantine at hotels in Anchorage provided by the company. It wasn't until that we had gained access to testing resources that we were able to revert those employees back to a 2 and 2, and that again that we worked very closely with NANA, the Northwest Arctic Borough. The Northwest Arctic Borough led they put together a COVID task force that was made up of all of the communities, the regional organizations, tech included. And then they came, and of course, Manilik Association, which is the native nonprofit for tribal health there in the region. And then they also formed a unified command team. So it was a really well-organized effort across the region and a task force that we continue to participate in actually on a weekly basis. As things are beginning to relax a little bit there in the region, and we're seeing numbers go down, the borough actually still has a mask mandate in effect that is anticipated to sunset at the end of this month. We were just attending an assembly meeting there in Cotsview yesterday, and they plan to review those mandates moving forward. And I'm going to that's kind of the broad answer from a regional perspective. And then maybe I'll have Wayne cover some of the more specific mitigation measures that were and are in place there at the mine specifically.
Yeah. For the record, Wayne Hall, Representative Hannon. So some of the specific examples of things we did at site, you know, a lot closed down the cafeterias, only being able to eat in your office or your rooms, mask mandates, closing down common areas, you know, the gymnasium, things like that. Mandatory testing when we started getting the testing equipment before you fly in from Anchorage. When you're flying in from the villages, getting tested as soon as they got to site. And then we implemented testing 2 days a week as well, just because sometimes there's people that don't have enough of the virus in their body to know whether they were positive or not. So, and as indicated, you know, us like others are starting to reevaluate those policies and change them a bit. So now we're going back to being able to eat together, which is a big one, I think, from a morale standpoint. Still have mask usage there because we are in the borough and want to make sure we're adhering to the borough requirements. Those are probably some of the big ones. We did some other things, like we had some thermal cameras set up in different areas so we could, you know, they would go off if somebody had a temperature, for example. So we're trying to be a bit innovative as well, and all the enhanced cleaning, et cetera. So quite a bit.
A follow up. So do you currently still do testing twice a week, or do you have reported vaccination status required?
We've got vaccinations required for new hires. The existing employees, it was voluntary. We're transitioning away from the twice a week, but unless you're a close contact, and then it's testing for 5 days every day. So we're literally right in the middle of a transition that just started this week.
And one follow-up. Do you know or can you share what your vaccination rate is for your current employees?
That's a hard one because I don't know that if all employees share that information, and we can't mandate it. I think last I saw were about 65%.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I know that, yeah, you did a really great summary of 2 years of pretty intense work that, you know, allowed you to keep operational. So thank you for that.
Any other questions from committee members for the presenters? Seeing none, I've got a few, and it's probably a little longer conversation than anybody wants to entertain. So if you've got to go, I understand. One of the things that that's up for debate, I think Finance gaveled in 40 minutes ago or so, and they were going to take up some amendments that have been debated pretty hotly, and a couple of them being 404 primacy at the state level, RCRA funding, totaling somewhere like $5.75 million or something like that. And I wanted to, because I'm a firm believer in the opportunity to exercise local control. And, you know, under your presentations earlier, you had a slide that referenced all the regulatory, policies that are in place as far as permitting and all of those requirements. But I wanted to ask specifically to Tech, what kind of opportunities do you see with, state primacy on 404? Permitting and requirements from the state level. What kind of opportunities do you see with that, or threats, or anything like that?
For the record, Wayne Hall, Mr. Chair, maybe I'll start off by giving our experience with when the state adopted primacy for the water discharge program or the APDS permit program. We were in a situation. And I'm not saying this is the same for everyone, but just as an example, where we struggled for years with US EPA trying to get revisions to our permits. We couldn't even get the permit writer to come to site to look at, you know, what we were trying to permit, to understand the nuances of you know, a stream that cut right through the ore body and was naturally high in metals and things of that nature, or and you know, see the things that we were talking about implementing, and just the incredible amount of time that and delays that took. And when state primacy came in, you know, you've got for water, DECs working hand in hand with Fish and Game. You know, people know each other; they know the state processes. They still have to be just as stringent as the federal government, right? It's still the Clean Water Act. You still got to adhere to that. That's the overriding law. State can be more stringent. But what we saw is it really accelerated the timelines on getting permits because of, I think, that local knowledge, that local understanding. You got typically people that have been in the state agencies for a number of years. They've got that institutional knowledge. So I think that's an advantage we could definitely see under the 404 program. I think the other opportunity is integration across the agencies. For example, State Historic Preservation Office, DEC, DNR, et cetera, Fish and Game. When that happens, again, I think there's a much broader understanding and the agencies can address their concerns with one another and come up with a unified ask to a permittee, you know, or requirement to the permittee. We see something similar to this between DEC and DNR and Fish and Game right now, called the Large Mine Permitting Team. That's just for mining. But when DNR enacted that, it really improved timelines associated with getting permits. And a couple things I just want to point out on the 404 program. I think there's a misconception this has to do with rivers and shorelines, coastal, and it's not. It's the wetland fill program essentially. So harbors and rivers, that's under Section 10 or Title 10. Where what the state's looking at is 404. And I think the other thing that I think we would see as an advantage is most of the time when you need a wetland fill permit, it's associated with infrastructure. You're building a road somewhere. You need to put a pad in somewhere to store equipment or build a building. So really the biggest need for wetland fill permits is the construction industry and DOT. Yes, we benefit, but we also need those kinds of infrastructure projects that those people are working on to help support our mines. So, you know, if they're getting permits more efficiently and mines are getting permits more efficiently, I think it just makes it better overall process.
Okay. Thank you for that. Go ahead, Ms. Mathias.
Karen Mathias, for the record. In talking with various people about primacy, there is a misconception out there that if the state has 404 primacy, that it allows them to just green light Pebble. And, you know, as Deantha showed you in that slide, of all the different local, state, and federal permits that are required for a large mine, that really is a misconception. Not only are there exceptions in the 404 that require continued federal oversight, like ports, which Pebble, you know, is part of the Pebble plan, but there are numerous other and permits. I mean, we can go back to that very, very busy slide to show that it's just erroneous to believe that primacy of 404, which would allow the state to be able to have a more cost-effective, more efficient process that will benefit construction, benefit road building, benefit other large projects, would somehow have this repercussion, because there's far too many other areas where there's a full process and extensive permitting requirements for any large project, including a large mine.
Despite the state taking over 404 primacy, each project, despite what it is, will have to still comply with federal law.
Absolutely.
Pretty much.
Mr. Chair, one other, for the record, Wayne Hall. One other thing that I should have mentioned that just dawned on me is there's a provision in wetland permitting where you have to call it compensatory mitigation. So if you fill in a wetland, you need to enhance a wetland or repair a wetland as part of that process, as part of that mitigation. And the federal government has some guidelines around how they like to do that, which I think are a bit restrictive. I think the state, there's a real opportunity to look at opportunities around one that we were thinking of is, could we help one of our local communities enhance and do a better job with their landfill and help them clean it up and put in better monitoring and those kinds of things. And, you know, it's still in the same watershed, but help, you know, a local community, which in turn helps the environment, which in turn helps the project, right, from a mitigation standpoint. So I think under a state program, there'd probably be a lot more flexibility on those in that compensatory mitigation process. Because right now, typically what happens is you pay a group that collects money, and then they go out and they buy lands and put it into, like, preserve status. It tends to be what you typically see nowadays.
Whereas if you could see the opportunity to helping out local cities or boroughs, exactly, or whatever, and that count towards your compensatory mitigation.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Kronk?
Of course. Not related to this.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this right here. And I really appreciate this because we have a mine being developed, you know, in Chetland, the Manh Choh mine. And me and Chair Peketek talk about this all the time, especially that local control aspect. Can you, I'm a retired teacher, so I'm always looking for, and I always say, you know, if our kids don't have a purpose, they're going to struggle. And this, you know, I see this. So how can you, I know it's a tough question, but can you explain or be able to tell how has this impacted your schools educating kids, you know? I guess I hope that's clear enough.
No, I Representative Kronk through the chair. Good questions. I'm trying to begin think of where I could begin answering. I mentioned earlier the school construction, but as far as education and education delivery, Red Dog has partnered with the school district for many, many years on several different programs.
a few programs, including a job shadow program, a career awareness program, direct outreach from our human resources department to the schools, working with kids. We've also been a longtime contributor to Alaska Resources Education. Not sure how familiar, if committee members are familiar with them, but ARE goes out to schools as well and educates students, Alaskan students, about the importance of resources in Alaska, but more specifically to our region and the communities there. I just feel like I think of a neighbor kid that lived next door to my parents and my dad. My late father spent his years working at Red Dog, and I think of that kid Josh who lived next door, and he would watch my dad come home on his R&Rs, and then he saw that on his time away from Red Dog that he had access to nice boats and snow machines and his ability to get out fishing and hunting and all the things this little boy Josh enjoyed doing. And it kind of became a goal of his, and he's 17 now, so I'm really watching him and curious what he's going to do with his when he becomes an adult. But it kind of became a goal, and it's not an uncommon story around the region of kids looking to Red Dog as a kind of a start to their career, a stepping stone maybe to other opportunities. And like you touched on, there's, I think, these, you know, access to jobs, they create hope. It gives young men and women a purpose when they have a job that they're responsible for and something to get up and go to. And I started my career at Red Dog at 18, and I was a laborer up there in the geology department at the time, and spent a few years there in several different departments before I wandered off and 4 years ago I returned to work for Tech in this capacity now. But I underscore the importance of what the mine has meant to the kids in the region and the way that they try to prepare to qualify for jobs when they're out of school. So I hope that answers your question. Happy to chat more afterwards too.
No, you did. Thank you. I appreciate that. I was just, you know, we talk about this. It's like, you know, no matter what, I grew up in the village, and just a lot of people aren't going to leave the village, but these projects allow them to have that cash economy. I mean, because I know when I was a teacher, I was explaining to the kids, it's like, you know, you can make a choice. You can have those four-wheelers, those boats, the snow machines, those trucks, but you're going to have to work for those. And projects like these give these kids that opportunity to stay in their community and be a valuable person in their community, but still do the things their life, their style. So I appreciate that.
Thank Absolutely. Thank you.
If I may, on those lines of community impact, one of the things that I think is maybe not as much known to a lot of people is, like, I think of Selowik, right, where maybe they got one truck in the village. And when I turned 16, you know, it was go over to the DMV, sign up, get my license, all that stuff, coming of age thing. But we had roads and we had trucks in our village. Do you guys do anything to that extent, as far as workforce development opportunities for children that maybe don't even, well, children becoming adults that don't even have the opportunity to get their driver's license or their CDL or anything like that in their village? Like, I mean, I think there's probably not even a legal way for them to get a CDL of any class in Selowik. But do you guys do anything like that with Tech or the Red Dog or anything?
Yeah, for the record, Wayne Hall to the chair. So we have done programs where we do the training around taking a driver's license, and then they'll go get a driver's license. We have partnered with ATC in Kotzebue around their trade programs and helping them design them. I don't know that we've done anything specific with CDL, but I can't imagine that we haven't at times tried to, you know, I know there's a place now in Wasilla past several years where you can get your CDL, and I've heard employees talking about going there to get, or that's where they got theirs. But the other thing I wanted to mention too is around sometimes it's not just the training on jobs and stuff. It's also the life skills. Well, I think one of the ones we're really proud of that I think is really worth mentioning, and I know they've been the students have come to before the legislature before, but there's a program that was started by a really influential woman a number of years ago. It's called the Youth Leaders Program, and it's really to combat youth suicide and bullying, and in really empowering those youth around getting the skills to be leaders, and it has been transformational. And you know, that's maybe another example where it's work, it's providing a different set of skills, but just as important when it comes to education.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, through the chair. And like Representative Kronk, I'm a retired high school teacher and got to, in my first term, take a visit out to Red Dog, courtesy of Red Dog and the Resources Committee, and the Voc Tech Center in Kotzebue. My recollection was that there was a substantial contribution to that from tech and perhaps from the tax base. And, you know, they did CNA courses, so it was described that kids coming in, bring in kids for 4 weeks, 6 weeks from the villages, and the most popular class that it was always stacked up was driver's license. Mm-hmm. That, you know, maybe the CNA class wasn't full, but the driver's license class, because you're coming from Kiana or Noatak, and maybe there isn't a way to get a license in the village. And yeah, you've been driving since you were seven, but it was an ATV, and it was, you know, they pointed it out that that was a class that anytime it's offered, it's full.
Yeah, hot laps around town, the quarter mile of road that you get.
Yes, slow down.
Oh, you have high school kids.
And making sure that it's street legal, because when you go to take that driver's test, it has to be a street legal vehicle.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I'll comment on that. When I was 16, I borrowed a vehicle in Kotzebue from a family friend to do my road test there. And the trooper afterwards let me know. He said, "Get who licensed me." It was performed by the state troopers there. He said, "Before you drive in Anchorage, though, be sure somebody goes out with you and works with you a little bit before you let yep. you loose on the Anchorage road."
You're street legal for Kotzebue.
Yeah, right. There's not even a street. I mean, if it's like Barrow, there's not even a street. Like I remember going into a turning lane in Anchorage, and I was like 17 or 18, and you know, the yellow lights flashing means you can go on caution, and I just, I'm just gonna go and almost get T-boned. It's like, man, I need my Anchorage certificate here. So. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. I guess this is for Ms. Sobey Skibinski or Ms. Mathias. I was wondering, on this map here, you identified six advanced exploration projects, two projects in permitting, and six large mines. So basically, of the two and the six advanced exploration projects, are any of them possibly ready to go in the next 2 or 3 years?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, can I clarify how many years you said, please?
2 or 3.
It's an important distinction. Thank you. Miners are commonly called gamblers, and this is why. It's really anybody's guess. I would say that there is a distinction here of projects in permitting. Both Donlin and Pebble are in that case where they have, in Donlin's case, completely gone through its federal permitting process, is still in the process of getting all of those state permits that you saw the differentiation on the other slide I had. These ones with the green stars, starred circles, whatever you want to call that shape, are ones that are in more advanced exploration but have not commenced permitting yet. But I would caution you from thinking that they would be any further away or closer to going into production. It's a whole bunch of different factors can indicate when a project or a project in permitting could go into construction, development, and then production. And I really don't want to make any predictions on the record. I hope to have some good news for you sometime.
Sure, I'll follow up real quick. Then, from what you had just said, has Mancho applied for any permits yet then? Because you said the ones that are in the green balls have not applied for permits. So I'm just trying to follow up on that one.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I will say that this is a map that we produced around this time last year.
Okay.
and we are in the process of refreshing. In previous years, for those of you that have served on this committee before, we've handed you a report of the economic benefits of Alaska's mining industry, and it looks at the previous year. So this is our 2021 report. Given that there's just a lot of new, really fascinating information to share, we commissioned McKinley Group to do a much deeper dive this year. So 2022's version isn't ready yet, but I suspect we would have a different display of Moncho on this map.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, and perhaps Representative Kronk will remember more specifically, but my recollection from the Moncho presentation is that some of the major sort of permitting hurdles that many mines would encounter, they don't have to because the mill and waste, because they're going to transport the ore to an existing permitted. So some of the more complex permitting is already completed, even though it's not for the Moncho, but it was because it's from...
I was there.
Kenra, yeah. And that the roads don't need the permit. And then
those are transportation permits they'll need. Yeah. But they won't need them, you're right. They don't
need them
because they follow under the weight restriction.
Right.
Any other questions or comments from committee members? Representative Fields.
I got back just in time, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question.
We held it over until you did.
Thank you. Just wondering if there are any potential state power generation projects that have been identified by AEA or that may be potential near-term projects that could reduce operating costs of either existing large mines or potentially mines that could come online and make more projects economical. And if you don't have the answer offhand, I'm not offended, but would be interested in learning that in the future.
This is Karen Mathias for the record, Representative Fields through the chair. So the mines that are currently on the grid, Pogo, Fort Knox, Isabelle, always benefit from improvements and efficiencies that would bring down the cost of energy on the grid. There is also Greens Creek is able to get quite a lot of their power through hydro. And whenever there's a need in Juneau for greater power, Greens Creek acts as the buffer, so they can revert to diesel if the community needs more. But then they can use hydro when there's an excess capacity. So that's a huge benefit. Any project that would result in lower energy would hugely increase the economics of the projects. But each one, has its challenges. So on the grid, absolutely. Some of the hydro power projects that are being looked at long term would be very advantageous.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I will say that from the angle that you presented your question, as far as indirect grids subsidizing, I don't use the word subsidizing, but helping out mining operations. The other way around, as far as I remember a presentation from Graphite Creek Mine that they were planning on standing up their grid and that it was going to connect to some of the villages nearby that would, kind of from the other way of your question, as far as mine opportunity creating a ease to the surrounding villages from a power generation standpoint. So if you...
Karen Mathias for the record, and that's very true with Donlin's pipeline opportunity. The opportunity for villages along that route to be able to access cleaner and cheaper gas rather than the diesel that they currently rely on would be a game changer in Western Alaska. Fort Knox also, when Fort Knox came into operation, they were able to provide the economy of scale for GVEA to be able to increase its capacity, and the result was lower cost for residential customers in Fairbanks. And Representative Hopkins, he's not here. probably knows about that being from Fairbanks. But for years, the bill showed, you know, your individual customers would receive a bill that said your bill this month has been reduced by X amount because of the project that Fort Knox contributed to.
Yeah, and I know back when Shell was starting to do their stuff offshore up on the North Slope, I was just getting involved with the local utility there from a board membership standpoint, and we had a like 8 megawatt capacity or something like that, and they worked with us to build up the megawatts to, I think, 20 or something. And so all of those, you know, public-private partnerships that happen, I pause there because I think not-for-profit utilities, I don't know whether they're public or private, but those types of partnerships between industry and what impacts it has on the local economy is something that I think is often overlooked. So any other questions from committee members before we look to close? Out of curiosity, going back to the discussions of wetlands and permitting amongst those, I know for the North Slope Borough, a majority of our jurisdiction is predominantly wetlands just because we're north of the Brooks Range, and that's kind of just all watershed after that. And I don't expect you to be able to speak in capacity representing the Northwest Arctic Borough, but I wanted to get an idea for their jurisdiction. Is predominantly the land in their jurisdiction considered wetland?
For the record, Wayne Hall. A lot of the areas are. Obviously, the higher topography, mountains and those kinds, don't tend to have the vegetation and soil characteristics that qualify it as wetland. But generally speaking, when you're talking about tundra, you're talking about wetlands mm-hmm. because of the nature of the soils and the vegetation.
Cool. Thank you for that. Any other questions from committee members? Any closing comments from the panel here?
Thank you.
All right. Are you sure we've got 25 more minutes? Kidding. I want to extend my gratitude for you guys coming out and presenting kind of on a broad state of Alaska basis for mining opportunities and operations, and then specifically to tech and what they're doing at Red Dog. And I think it's good for me to start to wrap my head around some of these things, seeing what's going on with the Upper Kobuk mining opportunities and how the state's being involved at a ADA level and excited to work through those challenges. So I want to extend my, again, gratitude for you guys to come out and present to us. Just want to let members know that on Friday we'll be pivoting from mining to oil and gas and going over to royalty and kind contracts with Marathon Petroleum and PetroStar on Friday. Then we'll break that up into two hearings. We'll have a kind of historical aspect on RAK contracts that the legislature has oversight on. I don't think we've done any since 5 years ago or so. And then the second half of the meeting, we'll actually dive into the specific contracts that we're dealing with. I just want to remind folks that two parts. Yeah, no. If I didn't communicate that clearly, we're going to have the 2-hour hearing, and it'll be two parts, first half learning, second half action. And so I just want to remind folks that the legislature cannot make any changes to the bills. It's an up or down vote. So if there's anything you guys want to do as far as pregame research on it, take your opportunity to do that. But we're going to try to get through all the questions on Friday. And if there are any specific questions that you come across beforehand that we can incorporate into the presentations, please get a hold of my office, and we'll do our best to facilitate that. With that, the meeting today, Ms. Shirk, did you want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One final comment. I wanted just to extend an invitation to you and members of the committee to come on up to the region and Red Dog at some point. We'd love to be able to host you and show you firsthand the operation. I know Representative Hannon mentioned that she had been up in recent years, but we'd love to have you. Thank you.
All right. That's on the record, so yeah. We're going to take you up on that.
And just so you know, George is a whole different guy on a plane and out of town.
Yeah. he loses the tie and the pins. Huh? All right, well, thank you for that, Ms. Shirk. With that, the meeting today is adjourned at 2:38 p.m. Thank you, everybody.